This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. I don't know about you, but in my house, Halloween is a big deal. We have a cemetery and an army of giant spiders in our yard. My husband puts as much thought into the candy as I do into the Thanksgiving menu. And then there's the trip to Salem, but not this year. This year, as the state's coronavirus infection numbers continue to exceed 1,000 new cases a day, cities and towns are asking their residents, dial it back on Halloween. And Salem has a clear message for anyone interested in visiting. Please stay away. Let's talk about what Halloween is and isn't in this 2020, how you feel about it, and what coronavirus questions does it raise for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by infectious disease physician Dr. Shira Doron, but we want to start with the mayor of Salem, Kim Driscoll. Mayor Driscoll, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So in a normal year, Salem doubles in population for Halloween. Can you take us to the moment when you realized that you had to actually ask people to stay away?
You know, we've been gearing up for Halloween this year. You know, it actually starts November 1st of the year before. And when the pandemic hit, we knew, you know, it wasn't going to be the same Halloween. There's five weekends this October. Halloween's on a Saturday. It's a full moon. It's daylight savings. It was certainly meant to be a really big celebration. But early on, I think we realized we needed to cancel all of the large gatherings. They just weren't going to comply with the phased-in orders. And I think it was pretty clear we were going to have people here still. I mean, Salem's had decades of people coming here for October. And Labor Day, I mean, it was a beautiful weekend. We saw a ton of people in town and knew we were really going to have to pull out the punches to make sure people understood the challenges, the rules of coming here. And it just progressively, as the month goes on, we really had to tell people, stay away. Don't come. People were still coming. They were younger. They weren't planning. And it was creating congestion.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you actually ask people to stay away, and they still don't. And you have actually had to take active measures, essentially to keep people away this weekend. Can you tell us about that? That's really striking.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's a year of the cats are biting the dogs. It, you know, normally we are welcoming costumed revelers here, and I'm imploring people to take the trains and, you know, not drive. And this year, you know, we're curtailing parking. There's no parking garages, public parking garages that will be open after noon. We have cut back train service both last weekend and this weekend, so there isn't going to be trains stopping in Salem throughout most of the day and evening on Saturday and Sunday. And we're having a mandatory closure of businesses as of 8 p.m. on Friday and Saturday of this weekend.
It really struck me. You told Yvonne Abraham in the Globe, I'm either killing every person or killing every business. October and Halloween make up, as I understand it, about 40% of the community's annual tourism income. Are you really stuck between a rock and a hard place with no good options here? Was there any other way it could have gone?
I mean, I think managing risks are really hard when it comes to local leaders having to make decisions around school reopening and issues like this. We love having Halloween. We love hosting people here. But with the restrictions in place, occupancies down, it just didn't make any sense to continue to welcome people into our community, knowing that when you're stationary and close together, you're running a higher risk for COVID. So it's not easy. We didn't take the decision lightly. But I think this year is about shared sacrifices. And, you know, we're grateful that we have a business community that we've been strong partners with, residents who have been patient, city employees who are just working their tails off to ensure a safe and healthy October. And we don't want to go back. Salem will be here after October. So it certainly is not easy, but we definitely think it's the right decision.
800-423-8255 to tell us what you're doing for Halloween. Were you planning to go to Salem and canceled those plans? How do you feel about the choices your community is making? You can join this conversation. Mayor Kim Driscoll, what are the positivity rates in Salem right now? I know the community is on the yellow part of the dashboard.
Yeah, we expect to stay in the yellow this week, but our case counts are going up. We're at like a 1.7% positivity rate as of this week, and we're seeing an uptick in cases along with many communities throughout Massachusetts. So we're concerned. We're prepared as well. I mean, I think we all expected there'd be some sort of a surge in the fall. We know this is a crucial time with colleges back in session, the weather getting, you know, getting cooler and people are being indoors more, and the uptick in visitors and the like. So we're still relatively low. We only had three COVID positive patients in our hospital today. So, you know, not where we were in the spring, but going in the wrong direction for sure.
In just a minute, I want to bring in Dr. Durome, but before I do, I want to play a little bit of sound with you. We spoke with Skip Dillon. He's the president of Wicked Amusements. He owns the Chambers of Terror in Salem. We talked to him a couple of weeks ago as part of our Living Through Corona series. Sorry, I'm having a little trouble speaking there. It was interesting because he said that he was disappointed to find out that he couldn't open, but he understood. Here he is.
The objective, decent, socially minded person in me says, well, you know what? At the end of the day, it's only money, it's only credit, it's only business, and you levy that up against people's lives. There's no comparison there. The scales are always going to fall in favor of the lives of people and the health of the public.
That's pretty philosophical for someone who can't open a piece of his livelihood. Is that what you're hearing from business owners, or are you getting pushback?
No, it's definitely a mix. I think the majority of our business owners understand there have been people in town. This has not been, you know, Salem has not been a ghost town throughout all of October, even with these additional measures that we've been putting in place. So businesses, I think, by and large, are still having a very decent month. It's not the same as it would have been, but it's not quiet. And there are people, of course, who, you know, want us to be fully open and don't want any regulations. And there are plenty who have already closed themselves, who've just said, we're going to shut down because our staff is more important to us and the risks they felt like were too high. So it has a range to it. But I think most of our businesses, and remember, small businesses here, these are independent operators. They are neighbors. They are friends. They are family members. We go to schools together. We celebrate lots of things as a community together. These are folks who want to be here after October. And there's a lot more to Salem than just Halloween.
Okay, so Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll, stand by for a second. I'm going to bring our second guest in. Dr. Shira Durone is an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. She also regularly takes your calls in our Ask the Doctor segments, and we're doing that today, 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Durone, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So you heard that part of my conversation there with Mayor Driscoll, who you're now joining. As an epidemiologist, are you concerned about this weekend, not just in Salem, but throughout the state?
Well, I'm watching it, certainly. I am interested to see, you know, how neighborhoods report the trick-or-treating goes, whether parents find it easy or difficult to make sure their kids follow the rules, and whether we see any kind of change in the numbers, you know, 2 weeks later, which is when we usually see the impact.
So the numbers have already been changing. I know you're aware of that, with positivity rates up, new numbers of new infections up. How alarming, if at all, is that trend to you, and what do you think it means?
We're very nervous in the hospital, certainly, and, you know, with our focus day-to-day being about making sure that we have the capacity to take care of patients, we watch those numbers very closely, and we definitely feel a sense of anxiety and dread when they are going up. Of course, you know, there is some good news. Although they're going up, they're nowhere near where they were during the surge, and we're looking at those age distributions and noting that they are on the younger side, which bodes well for, you know, what percentage of those new cases will end up hospitalized.
Let's go to the phones, Dr. Durone and Mayor Kim Driscoll, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shannon is on the line from Newton. Shannon, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question that relates to partners living in the same household attending different events. So, for example, if my partner wanted to attend, like, either Halloween events or Thanksgiving events that I don't feel comfortable attending, how much does that increase my own risk by not attending, but he does? Am I saving myself any, you know, by any amount, by not attending these events? Or if he's going to them anyways, is my risk sort of the same as his risk?
All right, let's ask that one to Dr. Durone. Dr. Durone, go ahead.
So the answer is yes. If you decide not to attend those events, you will have lowered your risk compared to his, because epidemiologic studies show that the rate of transmission within a household is actually only between 10 and 20%. So if your partner is willing to take a higher risk than you and does end up becoming positive and, say, asymptomatic positive, so without symptoms and you don't know it, you would still only have a 10 to 20% risk of contracting it from him or her.
Mayor Driscoll, what are you telling individual, you know, families, family units about safety in Halloween this year? We've talked about sort of the city, the town, but you've got all your residents.
Sure. For trick-or-treating, we're advising folks to follow the Mass Department of Public Health guidelines. And that means, look, avoid trick-or-treating if you can. But if you are planning to go out, you know, families should not congregate with other family members. Like, stick to your own household. Wear a face covering at all times. Stay 6 feet away from others. And if you're, you know, choosing to give out candy, to do it from a distance and not have communal bowls, those sorts of things. And then residents who don't want to participate, you know, turn off your porch light, your outside light for the evening, so that you're not disturbed.
What coronavirus questions do you have for Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll and Dr. Shira Durone? Or tell us what you're doing in your household, your neighborhood, your community. How do you feel about how your city or town is handling it as we begin this kind of multiple holiday season? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Chris on the line from Jamaica Plain. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, guys. So just sharing with you our holiday or Halloween plans to try and keep the spirit alive. We've took the potting approach. We live in a six-condo development in Jamaica Plain, and we've got together extra special little gift bags for all the kids in the condo, some candy, a little toy. We're going to be on our balcony. We're going to lower that gift bag down to them by a fishing pole with a ghost of a fish on the other end, just to kind of, you know, make it fun, but also keep our distance and, just keeping it small for this year so that we can all make it to next.
So, Chris, has that creativity made it a little more fun for you in some way? I mean, you got to think about the fishing pole and the ghost fish and how you're going to make it work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's been really fun. And it's just, you know, it's the same as the PVC candy shoots that people are thinking of. I think, you know, in times of crisis, it often brings out the best in our creativity, and we can just see that by the sheer number of vaccines and drugs that we're developing to face this crisis. So we can choose to make the worst of the best of any situation, and I'm glad to see people are picking the best for many of these challenges we're facing.
Well, thanks for that call, Chris. And listeners, I do want to say that people I know who are using the PVC piping approach, make sure the candy you picked fits down the PVC pipe, because I understand that is occasionally a problem. So, Dr. Durone, there are some safe ways to do some of these Halloween traditions, right? We don't have to take entirely yet another thing away from kids, do we?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, as Chris said, creativity is key, and everyone has to make their own personal risk assessment. And some people will have their kids trick-or-treating in the traditional way, and hopefully some people who are typically fans of Halloween and handing out candy will come up with safer ways, especially, you know, to hand out that candy, especially if they are older or more vulnerable, like putting out bags of candy or using the PVC chutes. And other people will not have their kids trick-or-treat, and they'll, you know, have small gatherings or gather with just their own family and do really fun scavenger hunt type things in their backyard. So there are so many options on the MassDPH website and the CDC website specific for Halloween ideas.
And by the way, listeners, I would love to hear your Halloween hacks. If you've gotten creative about how you're going to give out candy or another way you're going to celebrate because you don't want to do trick-or-treating or your city and town aren't doing it, call us, 1-800-423-8255. We'd love to hear them. Mayor Driscoll, have you seen some surprising creativity, some fun from families or residents, or even decorating? Maybe people have gone a different way than before in Salem this year?
Yeah, absolutely. The house decorations, we've got a scarecrow building contest that our Park and Rec folks put on, and there are some amazing creativity coming along with house decorations and scarecrows and things that light up at night. And, you know, Halloween, this is a pretty big holiday in Salem, so people definitely use their creativity to try and make sure they still were in the spirit, even though we're all doing things a little bit differently this October.
Over the next couple of weeks, and I want to ask this of both of you, you know, we are so concerned about our physical health, our public health. We've also talked a lot about our economic health, and we're beginning to increasingly talk about our mental health. Halloween is sort of the unofficial beginning of the holiday season. We've got Thanksgiving coming up. We've got Christmas coming up. We are already having conversations about the things people would usually do that they shouldn't do for all of these community-oriented holidays. How are each of you in your sort of professional capacities? And Mayor Driscoll, maybe I'll have you go first and then Dr. Daron. How are each of you advising people and supporting people as, you know, they struggle with the potential loss of these rituals and traditions? Mayor Driscoll.
Yeah, I think we're trying to, you know, reinforce the need to be kind to each other, that this is a heavy period of time between COVID, between elections, between loss of loved ones. We all need to give each other some space, be patient, and recognize that even if you need to be, you know, physically distanced from somebody, you don't necessarily need to socially disconnect. And, you know, I think even more importantly, really trying to advise people, as hard as it is to miss loved ones and miss traditions, this is not the year. We need to avoid social gatherings. We need to make sure we're all wearing a mask, going around others. And most importantly, here in Salem, we're asking everybody to get tested. Get tested twice a month. We've got a bunch of free testing going on thanks to our partnership with Governor Baker, the Stop the Spread initiative here. We're testing thousands, but we can't let up. And so our hope is that we can be a little bit kinder to each other, a little more patient with each other, and understand what somebody else might be going through.
So Dr. Daron, I'm going to invite you to answer the same question as Mayor Driscoll, but I'm going to add to it. Are we at a point where we can say to everyone in the Commonwealth, get tested a couple times a month, whether you're symptomatic or not? I know that's been sort of the end game for a while.
Yeah, so for the first part of your question, I do get the question many times a day, what should I do? What should I do about Thanksgiving? What should I do about the holidays? Should I visit my elderly parent? Should I allow my college kids to come home because I have an underlying medical condition? How do we do this? And I always say I can't answer for you, but you know, you do need to ask yourself, what's the level of risk I'm willing to take, and then understand how to mitigate those risks. And ask yourself too, you know, if the worst thing were to happen, could you live with that? So I hear a lot of people say, you know, a lot of elderly people say to me, I just don't want to be alone anymore, and I'm willing to take that risk because I want to see my family. And I totally get what could happen if I do that. And so that's an important conversation to have as a family when you're deciding whether to get together. As far as testing, you know, I think testing is very important, obviously. It's key to controlling the spread of infection. Testing people who are asymptomatic, because that's 40% of the people who do have COVID-19, is key. We're not where we want to be in terms of every person who wants a test whenever they want one being able to get one. And we do have to remember that when you do get tested, and a lot of people are going to get a test right before they go visit somebody, right before they go travel, or when they come back from traveling to a hotter spot, don't use it as a false sense of security. It is only a moment in time. It can add a layer of safety. You're not infected at this moment, and you're going to see your elderly mother tomorrow. That's good. But by tomorrow, know that you might have the infection even if you didn't have it today. And it's not what you do on the way there after the test. It's what you've been doing for the 14 days before the test, because that's how the virus works. It hangs out in your body up to 14 days after an exposure. So you still do have to take the precautions, the distancing and the masking, whenever possible.
I'd like to go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alice is on the line from Boylston. Alice, go ahead.
Hi. I have been babysitting my nephew on a regular basis, and they have been staying at home. We've been staying at home, and we have been comfortable with that situation. My nephew now has started to go to school live, and I have some real concerns about whether I can see him because of the exposure at school.
All right, let's talk to Dr. Daron about that. And then also, Mayor Driscoll, I want to talk to you about schools in general. But Dr. Daron, why don't you take first catch on that?
Yeah, so I understand the concern. I mean, people who have been really, really diligently staying within a certain bubble, it's going to change when someone in that bubble is interacting with many more people a day. And so, you know, that is sort of, you know, the reality of any kind of social reopening that families might be doing. The good news is that the data are very positive in terms of the lack of significant transmission happening in settings, school, camp, daycare, college, when proper protocols are being followed. And so if you trust that daycare, and if they are doing the right things as far as masking and hand hygiene and disinfection and distancing to the extent possible in that setting, it is likely that there is not a lot of transmission of the virus happening there.
Mayor Driscoll, what is the status of the Salem schools, and how well are you on track to the plan that you had in place at the beginning of the school year?
Yeah, well, our goal is certainly to have everybody in in-person schooling. We think there is no substitute for that in terms of meeting the needs of our students, and both academically, socially, and emotionally. Right now, we have what we call Tier 1 or higher priority students in sessions. We have about 700 students in person every day, and we have voted as a school committee to bring back our pre-K through second graders all in person as of November 16th, along with sixth graders and ninth graders in a hybrid model. And then we hope later in the year to bring back more of our students. You know, all of our buildings have been HVAC tested, and we've got decent size buildings to accommodate the space limitations. So that's where we're at right now.
Do you have specific data triggers sort of marked out that either say, yes, we can move on to the next phase, or no, we have to roll this back? Like, are there specific number thresholds?
Yeah, we're looking at metrics such as how, you know, obviously the state's designation, we're currently yellow. There are some requirements triggered by the different categories. I think we're also looking at percent positives and hospitalizations and wanting to be clear, like, what does a trend mean? There are a number of communities that have sort of ping-ponged between different, you know, between different designations. So we want to make sure we're clear on a trend. Is that 3 weeks or more is what, you know, has traditionally been held out? And how does the number of cases in our community also relate to what we're seeing with respect to the percent positive? We'll also be doing some sewer and wastewater surveillance, particularly tied to some of our schools to help us understand what the prevalence might be there. And for us, it's 3 weeks, numbers of cases, percent positive, and hospitalization rates. Those are the triggers we're going to pay most attention to.
Dr. Jerome, we've got about a minute left. You know, as these numbers go up, as we see, for example, the data from out of wastewater and those concentration numbers going up, I do have some flashbacks to last spring. Of course, one thing that was really different was how ready our hospital system was, how available PPE was. I mean, we talked about PPE every day. Can you give us a sense of how ready for a surge our hospital system is now?
Well, we're much better off in terms of readiness. We've tested so many different strategies and approaches to scaling up capacity. We've put ICU patients in non-ICU areas and adults in pediatric areas, and we've seen what works and doesn't work, and we know exactly what the next step and the next step will be in terms of those things. We certainly have more PPE, but we don't have a secure supply of PPE. We're not comfortable with where we are with PPE, and we're seeing other equipment shortages and drug shortages as well. So we're watching all of that very carefully.
All right, that is Dr. Shira Jerome, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, and Kim Driscoll, mayor of Salem, Massachusetts. Thanks to both of you for taking the time to talk about Halloween and the season with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you'll find a link to a list of cities and towns and what they're doing for Halloween on our website, radioboston.org. With Election Day right around the corner, we are continuing to look at some of the major issues facing the country and ask what is at stake in this election. Today, we're going to talk about energy and the environment. With us to do that is Shalonda Baker, a professor of law, public policy, and urban affairs at Northeastern University, where she specializes in environmental and renewable energy law, and Emily Reichert, CEO of Greentown Labs, the largest climate tech startup incubator in North America, which is based in Somerville. Shalonda and Emily, welcome.
So glad
to be here. Thank you so much.
Great to have you both. So let me start with a question for the two of you. And Shalonda, that's right. Correct, Shalonda? I just want to make sure
that's
I'm
correct.
Saying it right.
Yes.
I'll start with you. When it comes to energy and the environment, what do you think is at stake in this election, both for voters in Massachusetts and across the country?
Well, I think it's a choice between a candidate who really sees climate change as an existential threat and is committing to making some pretty significant investments over the next 4 years in mitigating the potential impact of climate change. And a candidate who has, over the last 4 years, really moved to scale back commitments with respect to the environment, has questioned climate science, and is very much committed to an energy security approach that makes fossil fuels a central feature of the platform. So I think that is the choice.
Emily, is that the same? Do you share that, or is there more you would add?
Well, absolutely. I think Professor Baker said it very well. And as an organization whose mission is to support climate tech startups and tries to inspire action on climate change, the differences between the two candidates just seem very stark to us. Like many issues, I think it's hard to understand where President Trump really stands on this one. He says in some statements that climate change is a hoax, other times not a hoax. He often seems to conflate environmental stewardship with climate change, with statements like he believes in crystal clean air and water. And I don't think anyone disagrees with this, but to address climate change, we specifically need to focus on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And we need to do that with thoughtful policy to address inequities that already exist and not create more. And so I think the choice between the two candidates, one has a comprehensive plan to move forward on this front, and I don't think the other does. Just based on seeing what has happened over the last 4 years. And I do not see too many opportunities for things to change radically in the next 4 years.
All right, I want to comb a bunch of that out. And because you made this reference, I'm going to play that sound, Emily, of President Trump talking about crystal clean water. This was at the first presidential debate.
I want crystal clean water and air. I want beautiful, clean air. We have now the lowest carbon. If you look at our numbers right now, we are doing phenomenally, but I haven't destroyed our businesses.
So I want to comb this out with the two of you. Presidential candidates have had environmental platforms and energy platforms for decades, but now we have this added dynamic of climate change and the question of whether each presidential candidate both believes in climate change and has a plan around climate. So let's just be clear. What is the difference between a general environmental and energy policy agenda and an agenda that is rooted in belief in climate change? Professor Shalonda Baker, let me have you start there.
Sure. So I think it's helpful to know that candidate Biden has three different but substantially overlapping plans. And as you alluded to, Tiziana, the plans connect to climate, they connect to energy, and he's really focusing on environmental justice in the plan that relates to the environment. With respect to climate, it's really about lowering emissions. And Joe Biden's plan sets forth a couple of really significant goals. One is a 100% carbon-free electricity sector by 2035. And Biden has sort of set forth several different pathways for that, but is essentially neutral with respect to the types of technologies that can get us to a net zero electricity sector by that year 2035. And some of those technologies include nuclear, carbon capture and storage, and of course, a commitment to renewables. Another significant aspect of his climate plan really connects to environmental justice communities. So, you know, you mentioned that obviously we're facing a threat with respect to the climate, but we're also facing a threat with respect to COVID, right? A global pandemic, mm-hmm. which you talked about in your last segment. And environmental justice communities who have sort of been in the shadows of fossil fuel generation for decades are uniquely impacted by that pandemic. And Biden's plan allocates 40% of climate investments in those communities, mirroring the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in New York, which was passed last summer. The other aspect of his plan really tries to dispel this notion that you cannot move forward on climate while also maintaining a robust economy. And his commitments are deep in the agricultural industry, saying we want to move to biofuels and advanced biofuels, as well as labor. There's a lot of talk about a so-called just transition, which means we want to ensure that those in the coal industry and fossil fuel industry are not left behind as we transition. And candidate Biden really, you know, takes great pains to sort of spell out how he will bring them in this transition. So there are lots of aspects, again, three overlapping, very comprehensive plans. But as to climate, it's really about reducing those emissions and achieving net zero emissions by 2050.
So, Emily, Shalonda just laid out a lot for us there. I want to tie it back to the clip that the cut that I just played from President Trump. Mm-hmm. The last thing he says is, but I haven't destroyed our businesses. And critics have said that the Republicans and President Trump in this sort of standoff between the two views of energy and the environment policy have pitted climate change steps against business and economic development. You represent a company, a climate tech startup incubator. President Trump has made some progress on clean air, although some of that came before. He definitely has kind of an America first, as Jeff Brady said of Trump's agenda on NPR, energy dominance agenda in American independence. What is the relationship between that and the business community? And do both candidates have an eye on the business ball in a productive way?
Well, I think what the business community generally wants is stability. And the business community generally wants to understand that the regulations that are in place are going to be there for a long time so that they can plan against them. And I open my comments by saying that I believe President Trump is somewhat all over the place when it comes to what the message is. I do agree that there is a strategy around American energy dominance, but that seems to be translated into maximizing the extraction of fossil fuel resources from our own shores so that we don't have to depend on foreign sources of energy that are traditionally in less stable parts of the world, like the Middle East. This sounds like a good thing in principle, except that it is really diametrically opposite to the strategy that the U.S. should be taking to act on climate change. And again, that's really about decreasing carbon emissions and other co-pollutants. And so specifically, the president's policies have tended to actually increase carbon emissions in the atmosphere by replacing the Clean Power Plan with the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, which has weaker regulations, attempting to freeze fuel efficiency standards imposed on new vehicles, really after the car companies in America and around the world already are on the march towards EVs. So that's, again, getting to that instability that is very unclear for business to be able to react and respond in a way that makes sense financially. But I think that the biggest issue is actually one of leadership. And our leadership on climate is sorely lacking with this particular president. With that focus on America First policy, the administration decided to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, which committed the U.S. and every other country in the world, every single other country, to keep rising global temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius. All other countries agree and remain in that treaty. I think finally, the president has not announced a plan to tackle climate change that is comprehensive. You know, going to that IPCC report from 2018 that said we have really 10 years to make a difference in order to stave off the worst effects of climate change, the president's policies are not going to do this.
You know, so the final
just say is that yeah. It's somewhat ironic, honestly, that the market forces, the business community, so to speak, are doing some of the emissions reduction work for the president. So burning coal to produce electricity is one of the most significant greenhouse gas emission sources, but more generating plants of this type have closed during Trump's time in office than in Obama's because it's not economically competitive compared to natural gas and renewable sources of energy.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there just because I need to be able to ask some questions and sort of follow up on some of what you've just said. I do need to say, we've only got a couple of minutes left, the two of you are clearly very clear that you believe that candidate Biden has a stronger set of plans than the current president. And we do know that the current president has questioned the existence of climate change, and that is a huge issue in this election. I do want to ask about Americans who rely on coal, oil, natural gas, the national security dimensions of American energy independence, and the fact that both of you come already from the perspective of renewable energy and green energy. What is the answer to folks who rely on coal for their living? What is the answer to the $2 trillion price tag that Joe Biden's policy proposal would require? What is the practical path forward that brings all Americans along? And Shalonda Baker, I'll ask you to start.
Thank you, Tiziana. So, I think it's helpful to think about the $2 trillion investment in the context of what's happening now. That investment is on par with the CARES Act, right, which is around $1.8 trillion, so, which is nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's a lot of money.
It's a ton of money. And, I think the things that are so there are a lot of gaps in Biden's plan. I mean, there isn't a clear framework for implementation. We know that that money is going to have to move quickly through the states, through various policies and programs. But what he does do is he sort of carves out a guarantee for those in the coal industry. And I think, a lot of folks who work in the space are clear that any transition has to happen with those communities in mind. And so, I think the details are sparse, but the types of investment that will be needed in clean energy technology and innovation, which he does outline in some level of detail, provide a place for many of these communities, right? They provide a place for those who are phased out through this transition. I think, there's been a lot of talk about how Biden's plan is not the Green New Deal, it's the Biden plan. But when you put these plans side by side, I mean, there is a lot that is borrowed from the Green New Deal, and the Green New Deal is very much committed to ensuring that labor commitments are met, as well as, the concerns of people of color, of environmental justice communities are also cared for in this transition. So, in short, I think there are a lot of details yet to be fleshed out, but there is a placeholder for those communities that you called out in your question.
And Emily, just briefly, I'll let you add on to that before we sort of do a wrap question here.
I think it's fairly simple. If human beings fail to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the levels designated in the Paris Agreement, the global economic cost is estimated to be $150 trillion. Or as much as $792 trillion, which is hard to even contemplate by the year 2100. So, again, as Professor Baker said, we just spent this much in a very short time period because of COVID. We're asking, those of us who are really passionate about trying to ensure that the United States acts on climate and cares about making sure that these jobs of the future get to people as soon as possible, because we're making this transition in a way that is smart and strategic and comprehensive. Those of us who really want that to happen, you have to look at the scale of what's the alternative. What happens if we do nothing? And that is really frightening to contemplate. And, wherever you go in the United States, you are facing some impacts of climate change right now, and it's staring you right in the face.
Thank you. That's Emily Reichert, CEO of Greentown Labs, and Shalonda Baker, Professor of Law, Public Policy, and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Almost exactly a year ago, three Boston-based drag performers, Binks, Severity Stone, and Kirby Fully Loaded, came into Studio 3 fully dressed in attire that was inspired by this time of year. And we talked about the importance of Halloween to the drag community, as October is traditionally the busiest month of the year for drag queens and kings, and a time when many future performers experiment with drag. But of course, this year's different. Our inability to gather means no in-person drag shows, but it has inspired performers like the ones we spoke with last year to get creative and go virtual. So to see how that's being done, we caught up with Binks as part of our series, Living Through Corona. Binks told us that while every Halloween is special, it is particularly disappointing that things won't go on as usual this year.
This Halloween would have been even cooler, especially it's a full moon. I believe it's a blue moon. It's on a Saturday, and we would have had an extra hour rolling the clocks back.
I forgot about that. You're kind of bumming me out.
Yeah, this Halloween would have been like, it's like the chosen Halloween, and then everything is just kind of lost with Corona.
And what would you have been doing if so much weren't lost because of Corona?
I try not kind of to think about it a little bit. I really don't know what I would have been doing this Halloween. Last year, maybe like a week or two ago, I think like on October 13th last year, I was performing on stage at the House of Blues with Charli XCX. So I can only imagine what this Halloween I would be doing, if not something cooler than that.
The pandemic has hit so many people hard, Binks, when it comes to loss of work, loss of income. You told WBUR in the spring that just before the pandemic, you had actually been able to transition to 100% of your income coming from drag. What happened once the shutdowns began?
I kind of just had to hope that I could get pandemic unemployment through that way because I no longer had any job. I could do stuff online. It didn't really start up right away with online shows. And when they first kind of started, there really weren't any money coming through them, just tips through whoever decided they wanted to tip virtual drag. And then now sometimes you can kind of get some money doing digital drag. It is fun because like when I was a little kid, like I always wanted to like edit and make music videos for like all my favorite pop stars, but like editing actual virtual drag is really time consuming and really hard. Wasn't like prepared to be a music video director like last year.
Just, you know, for listeners' perspective, so much of drag is about the creativity. You know, you're starting from scratch with fashion, making your own outfits, doing your own makeup. So how have you adjusted?
Yeah, well, it went from like performing in bars and performing at clubs and at restaurants and places. And then now I have to add in an extra element where I'm now editing my own videos and directing my own videos and kind of coming up with ideas for videos that like I wasn't doing before. It's a new element of being creative, but it's also like a new element of like, now I have to make a whole entire video and like have it in on time instead of just coming to the venue and, you know, performing in front of everyone the way I was used to.
Has it changed anything about what you can do with fashion or makeup?
Not so much makeup, but like for fashion, I would go to a show and I would perform in my one outfit. I might have a reveal into a second outfit. But now when I make a video, I kind of like to have a couple outfits because it just seems more entertaining to me when I can see a couple outfits. But then making a video like that, it's more work because then I have to change three times in a matter of whatever the 20 minutes that I filmed the video in. And it can be like kind of, and it doesn't feel like it's enough almost when like, I don't know, you like watch like music videos and they have like Lady Gaga has 11 outfit changes in her Bad Romance music video. And I'm like, well, I just did two outfit changes.
Like you wish you could do more.
Yeah. But then like editing the video itself takes like 5 hours sometimes. And it's just like, what am I doing this for exactly?
I want to stay on this digital question for a minute. RuPaul's Drag Race, which is the pinnacle of drag, put on a huge virtual finale this year, very elaborate. Lots of other types of performance organizations and performance venues are also moving to something more digital or different ways of practicing their art and their craft. I wonder, are there any aspects of the quarantine that have brought out something new that you value or that you think have enhanced what's best about drag? Anything there on the inspiring or hopeful side?
I do like the digital aspect of drag. I think it really has taught a lot of people how to incorporate like all the technology that we have in the world to make their drag like a visual presentation. When you audition for a show like Dragula or Drag Race, you know, they're going to ask for an audition tape. And now all of us who've been doing digital drag learned a little bit more about how to make and record ourselves and produce these things so we can look better for something like that in the future.
You're organizing a digital fashion show for Halloween. Can you tell us about that?
I am. Before the pandemic happened, this was the show I wanted to do in person. And I was watching everybody do digital drag, and I was doing digital drag, and I was like, why don't I do this fashion show digitally? And I was going to do it around Pride, and then I just didn't feel like the timing was right. And the more time that passed, I was like looking at Halloween. I was like, okay, I think this is going to be the perfect time.
So you're embodying the runway witch. And in a trailer for the show, you preview some just incredible fashions that you've made. And you note on Instagram that they're sort of inspired by powerful women from your childhood. Tell us about the runway witch and tell us about the fashions.
So the runway witch, I actually came up with way before I was doing drag. When I got out of high school, I worked at a Nordstrom and then I worked at Saks Fifth Avenue. So I was always working in kind of like luxury fashion, but I was always working in men's. And some people would tell me, oh, you should do drag, you should do drag. And I was like, oh, I could like never do that. But I was always kind of on the edge of like men's fashion isn't really giving me what I want. And I can't exactly just walk out in women's fashion. I could, but it would just be like a big leap for me to just all of a sudden be doing that in my everyday life. And then I kind of just, through watching mostly Drag Race, I think it was like Aquaria that kind of like made me look at it and be like, okay, I really could do this. And so I started doing drag. And to me, it was never really about the wigs or the makeup. It was always about like what I could wear, how I could style myself. And I was buying a lot of clothes at first. And then last summer, I finally got a sewing machine and I just sat down and taught myself how to sew. And I've just kind of never looked back since.
When we did talk last year, one of the things that we talked about was how drag is a truly safe and expressive space for so many people. Back in the spring, Kirby Fully Loaded called it queer church in an interview with The Artery at WBUR. With these changes that we are living through in the pandemic, has that safe space persevered? And have you had to do anything to preserve or recreate it?
It's hard to go to church when you can't actually go to church, but like we're still a community. It's just hard because we're not together. We can't communicate with each other in person. It's just all through social media now. So it definitely feels a little bit less togetherness and more like we're just like looking at each other like through like the glass window of a toy store.
And any words of encouragement for others who are missing that ability to be together and not sure when that's going to come back?
We are still always together, but it's just kind of sad to say like it is through our online community and it is through social media that we are together until we can meet again.
Binks is a drag performer in the Boston area. You can catch Binks's digital Halloween fashion show tomorrow night at 10 on Twitch and Saturday night at 6 on YouTube. And you can find a link to Binks's Instagram, which has more information on our website, radioboston.org. Binks, thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.